Welcome to the 2015 Thanksgiving in the Park meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. I don't know how anonymous we can be in a park, but we're here. My name is Deanna, and I am a compulsive overeater, and leading this meeting.
Hi,
Deanna. Hi. Will all who wish to please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Are there any compulsive eaters here besides myself? Okay, in honor of the Thanksgiving holiday, we are reminded of the many gifts this program has given us. The following speakers will be sharing their experience, strength, and hope with us today. Our first speaker is Alexis.
Hi, I'm Alexis, a compulsive overeater.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, man. Okay. I'm just going to open up with the acceptance prayer. So if you would like, you can totally follow me along. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, some situation, some fact of life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it's supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's will by mistake until I could accept my alcoholism / compulsive eating. I cannot stay sober until I could accept life completely on life's terms. I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitude. I'm sorry I'm crying, but that was something that my first sponsor had me read every time I would call her ranting. And I could never get past person, place. I can never get to things. It was always a person, place. And I would just cry. She would read it to me on the phone, in a drive-thru, at a park, at a babysitting gig. And finally, it sunk in. I just want to say I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful for this opportunity to be able to share the message. To give a backstory on my history, before coming into program, I was maybe no more than maybe 35 pounds heavier than this, no more. I would say between 25 to 30 pounds. My history is bulimia, anorexia, restricting, fasting, anything to kind of manage my weight that minus food. and then there will be waves of me overeating, but most of the time I was restricting and trying to control it. My history, has a lot of trauma, a lot of gruesomeness, blood, gore, screaming, crying. A lot of the beginning of my story just revolved around me being in my closet crying, just a lot, just screaming and crying and wanting to leave home. A lot of people who's been in these rooms heard a lot of pieces of my story. It makes sense why the food was so important to me, because life was really unmanageable. Life is still unmanageable, but I don't have to be the person to fix it right now. Just for today, each day at a time, I don't have to fix it. My life before program was me and my family moving farther and farther away from family. We ended up moving finally out to Adelanto, and that's where the really food obsession became, because I started hiding food in my cubby and under my bed, which is a great place to put your bags of whatever it is. But normally when I opened my cabinets, I could hear the rustling. It was insane. Eventually I went into foster care, where then eventually my grandma took me on after a year in there, and I went from hiding and eating, not really into my restrictions, but then into exercise bulimia. My grandma is a very healthy woman. She has her own restrictions and her own food dietary needs, and I thought maybe if I got thinner, I could be more a part of her life. My life before was tremendously a wreck. Like, nothing, I mean, I had shoes that were, like, size 12, and I was, like, a size 8. I mean, I looked a hot mess, like, a hot mess. And my grandma just kind of wanted to transform me. That meant physically. That didn't really mean spiritually. But she did the best she could. My life in restriction looked as if early morning at 3 o'clock in the morning, getting on a spinning bike, which my grandma had lots of those. She still does, and finds either a video, thank you, a video or some kind of a commercial diet, commercial or anything, just anything to kind of fixate my thoughts on how I want it to look so I can keep staying there. It got to a point where I was finally introduced to laxatives, and that started off as like once a day, and it, before joining the program, shortly before that, it was up to like 5, maybe 8 times. So I was probably barely eating anything, and I was having laxatives. And my entire day going through high school was me literally living on a bag of hot Cheetos, like the entire day, and like having the laxative before going home, and then like going into this carb frenzy once I got home and hiding it. And as a reflection of that, my weight went up tremendously, and it went down and it went up, and that body dysmorphia that I've seen in the mirror was emotionally draining, trying to be something, trying to reach for something with my body image that I don't really think I can even, you know, get. You know, I'm always trying to reach for something. That's kind of been my disease, trying to reach for some kind of solution. My story joining program was I started a new job and in Westwood, and I was probably there maybe like 2 months, barely, and I had just came from a lunch where I was just like binging my brains out, like just going in on like the chips and like all the crunchy, as I call it, the crunchy, cheesy, saucy, and sexy foods. That's what I like. And I had to sub in a classroom, and I went into the classroom, and there was another girl there. And she was nothing like me. I mean, completely nothing like me. She was talking about how bloated she felt and uncomfortable, and she was sitting on the floor, and we were next to a child, and the child just, you know, went to sleep. And she started talking about how she felt and how the food was for her. Shortly after that, she told me that she was in a program. Well, she said, I don't really go to the program. I just sometimes go to the meeting. And I was like, okay. And she was like, but, I think there's some great stories in there that I can relate to. And I was like, okay. But I could relate to her story. She just talked about how her day was, how her food was, how it looked, how bloated she felt, how uncomfortable she felt, even though she fit into her pants. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, what? And she told me about that. It was a Friday, and I went to my first meeting a Saturday the next day. Like, I've always been very hungry. My grandma even said it, like, physically hungry and then always hungry for a solution. Like, I've always been desperate. I've always wanted, as my sister would say, I'm kind of a perfectionist because I've always looked for the solution, no matter if it was at school or volunteering or doing something. Like, I've always been that person to be like, I have to be there. I have to be doing something to get me closer to whatever. I don't know where I need to be. But anyway, the next day I went to a relapse meeting, which was fabulous, and I loved that meeting, and I seen someone here that was from that meeting, and I just started crying because it just brings me back to how powerless I was when I walked into these rooms. Like, just completely and utterably that vulnerability of not knowing, but being okay that someone in the room will be able to guide me. And that was kind of how my program looked then, you know. The rooms were my higher power. So I went to that meeting, and I immediately took a delegate's commitment. Like, what the hell? Like, I had to be involved. Like, I had to be involved. And then maybe, like, a month later, I joined the OA birthday party. What was I thinking? But my issue has always been not being a part of, so I've always done things that were a part of. God knew, oh my goodness, didn't he? That was a good trick for me at that time, and still now. And I joined the OA birthday party. Probably shortly after joining the OA birthday party, I ended up starting the steps, and during that time I had a lot of crying doing the first step. I'm powerless over things. And I have to say, at first, I did not believe that life was unmanageable. That life, not just the food, but life was unmanageable. It took several tries, several times of me obsessing over the scale, a lot of obsessing over the scale, obsessing over, oh, now I can have enough salad and, like, control the food. And it worked until the 20-pound, I call it the freshman 20-pound, was done and I plateaued. And then it was on to the second step, creating a higher power, a power greater than me. At that point, I had switched sponsors. I mean, I felt so mortified having to switch sponsors. I mean, I heard it in the program, but it just felt like, wait, this is perfection. I have to do this. I have to continue with the sponsor. I have to give all of my recovery. And what I learned is that the sponsor was the best person to help me practice how relationships look. I can let things go. And she's so about it. I'm just so grateful for her. I started the second step using some of the characteristics that she had for her higher power. And then in collaboration with working with my current sponsor, I ended up making more characteristics. Most of them were pretty strong characteristics, things that I put into myself that I needed for myself, and now I was kind of placing them on the outside of me. And that was the most, I think, probably for me, was probably the most, the hardest thing, because in this disease, I've always wanted to control my food. I've always been the type to be like, I can have a salad, I can have a salad, I can have a salad, I can have lettuce, I could do this, I can have everything in a box. And life is on life's terms, so sometimes meals don't work out the way they're supposed to, and I still need to call someone. And to work in the second step and keep tripping and having moments where I am having those late dinners where I'm going out with friends having coffee, and then like, I can't help it, I'm eating soup. Now I'm eating chicken. Like, how does this happen? It just was like, I got tired of being tired. I have to say, I'm so grateful that my sponsor particularly allowed me to go through the steps with all the tripping and with all the falling and all the shortcomings and all the crying. Because a lot of times in the second step, I kept being pressed to wanting to go back to laxatives, to try to erase everything. That's basically been a part of my story, trying to erase it, trying to erase what's inside of me. That's mainly what laxatives did for me. They erased what was inside of me, and then eventually I would get something on the outside, eventually. But what I kind of learned in step two was that turning, like, my will over, my will was one of the characters that I wanted my higher power to have. And I wanted him to have a strong will. I wanted him to have a plan for me. And in that step, I learned that he does have a plan for me. So going into the third step, just turning my will over, that looked simple at first. And then I realized I even cried more. I cried even more because I guess I realized that my higher power wasn't strong enough that I made it the second step. I had more food issues, more compulsion at that time. But I still went through the steps. And my powerlessness over food and life, the spectrum of it got larger and larger. I realized that it wasn't the food. And I think for me, coming into the program, it took a really long time for me to realize and take the focus off the food and realize that it is, it's embodied in every conflict, every interaction that I have with another human, every person, place, thing, situation. It just keeps going back to that for me. Going into the fourth step, was simple, but being in the fourth step was hard. Because of the trauma that I went through my childhood, I had an outside source that allowed me to filter through some of that stuff, but the fourth step actually allowed me to place it on paper. And during that time, I started to introduce the trauma, my mom, who was a part of my trauma, into the program. And that was interesting. It still is interesting. It's still uncomfortable. But it's not my job to figure out how things work or if I'm uncomfortable with her being in a meeting. I just bring her here and, you know, let the rest go. And that's kind of what I learned in the fourth step, being rigorously honest, and especially when it came to relationships, focusing on relationships and more. My fourth step got really, really rough towards the last maybe 2 months of it, and it's because I joined another program that allowed me to be even more vulnerable and more accessible to the steps at a whole different dimension. A way to describe that would be probably the first 3 steps, I was like in a closet and the door was barely open, and I can see like a little crack of the light and a little bit of the hope and a little bit of the trust, everything that they talk about in the program. But once I kind of started going towards the end of the fourth step, the door became wider and the light became wider, and the trust and the hope for something better for me when it came to the food obsession and the food restrictions and everything that I wanted for myself when it came to life in general, to my career, to my family, to the relationships that I wanted to develop. It just, a piece of it became more warm to me. And after the fourth step, I felt like I was hit by a train. It was just so rough and so heavy that, I realized that I did the best I could in that step. I just cleaned house, as my grandma would say. And for me, doing that allowed me to really, really, open up to how much, my shortcomings and my character defects affect the way I interact with people. They affect the reason why I have a conflict at work. I run back home and want to eat. It's urgent. It's extremely urgent for me in my soul, in my gut. I had an experience during that part, going into my fifth step, and it was interesting. I wasn't in the food, but I had a scale at home, and it was a glass scale, and my thought, not eating, the second thought after, should you eat, is like, let's go clean up, or let's go play tennis. That's kind of, you know, where I was in the fifth step. And I was like, okay, I'll go home and clean. And I'm cleaning the floor of my bathroom, and this is how I know my higher power has a lot of humor, like, unlike me. I'm cleaning the floor, and, like, there's a quick thought in my mind, like, ooh, tomorrow I could get on the scale. Like, hell yeah, I could get on the scale. And shortly, I moved the scale over, just tiny, I swear, it was a tiny bit, and it just collapsed, and then it didn't just collapse, or like, it broke in half, it like, broke into these pieces, and the pieces, like, tick, 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 and, like, instead of me, that's how I knew my character defects were, like, falling off, instead of being, like, what the F, you know, I was, like, awesome, God, this is awesome, and I called the fellow, I was, like, this is awesome, kids, like, you won't believe what just happened. And me and my disease would have been angry. I would not have been able to, like, weigh myself. I would not have been able to value myself on the scale. Like, what? That's how I figure out who I am for today, by getting on the scale. And it wasn't like that. And, I mean, I guess to close, really, by that time, which is probably like 6 months ago that happened, I haven't gotten on the scale and I still struggle with it. I struggle every day. But the one thing I think that's changed for me is my evolving of my higher power. Me now going into the 8th step now. And I kind of told Deanna about this a while back on our road trip. But my higher power, I thought I should just describe it, is not anything tangible anymore. And I came into these rooms with a religious bag, but not really wearing any kind of spirituality. And now today, my higher power kind of looks like this. It's like, for me, when I came to the program, I felt like I had a hole in my heart, like an actual hole. And for the longest time, I would use relationships as like a kind of like a crock pot top. And I would cover the hole and it would simmer and it would get all warm inside. And I'm like, yes, that's the solution. And working the steps, it's kind of like a net. And there's air breathing through the heart. And there's triumph and there's roughness and there's everything. But there's still some air going in there. But it's not always warm. And that's kind of how I see my higher power. Like, it's working through me, working through the stuff. It's not always tangible. I'm not going to be able to touch it or grasp it with my hand, but it's working through me. It's working through me. And I finally wrote it down like a couple of days ago, what I thought about this. And it's just like, that's me right now. Like, things are not perfect. Hardships are happening. Troubles are happening. I'm, you know, dealing with my brother struggling with homelessness and my sister prostituting. And I have to show up for these things. Imperfectly, but I don't have to fix them. My experience, my hope, and my strength is the only thing I can give them. It's nothing tangible. It's no monetary thing. And every time I offer those things to them, they call me later and tell me that it was enough. And before I had to have enough of those experiences to realize that my experience, my existence is enough. And I'm still struggling with that, but I have more warmth as a whole over my body. I feel warm by the universe. I don't need to have a comforter or a blanket covering me, shielding me, making me warm. I can live in trust. I can live without boundaries. I can live without the actual Platian. So, is that my time? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexis. What a gift. I mean, that's worth giving thanks for. Sheila, please come to the microphone. Sheila will share her experience, strength, and hope.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm really glad to be here. And, Alexis, thank you. That was beautiful. Where'd you go? That was just beautiful. I love you so much. You are such a great example here. I don't know that I've ever seen you in the rooms or at an event where you're not smiling. And you are just so joyful. And that just feels like one of the real gifts here. So thank you. Thank you. Great share. And I want to thank Deanna and Carla. I know that there are probably other people who are also involved with getting this together. And I remember in the beginning, I've been in Overeaters Anonymous, I guess now 28 years, and I used to come to things like this and I'd think, oh, isn't that great? You know, there's a little thing for me to slide into and slide out of. It's amazing how those things just happen. And it's really powerful. You know, the people who just kind of laughed and smiled are the people who do a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff in terms of the service. And there's just a lot to do here, and it took a lot of work to get this off the ground, and I just really want to thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for your service. And I love Overeaters Anonymous. I love OA. And in the Family Afterward chapter, it's chapter 9, it talks about how experience is the thing of extreme value. Supreme value, I think it actually says. Experience is the thing of supreme value. So I want to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I think it's really important to be very candid and tell the truth. And again, I know how to share this in a general way, and it is a general way, but my top weight was 200 pounds. I weigh about 135 now. I've been absent for 15 years. I was a chronic slipper for a dozen years. And I really struggled with sugar. Sugar was the thing that I had real problems with. And when I was 4 years old, we had a family friend who was a grocer, and he used to give me inappropriate kisses in exchange for candy bars. And I can remember the day, at 4 years old, I just thought, I'm not going to endure those kisses anymore. I'm just going to start stealing these things. And I did. So stealing was a big part of my story, right? So I started at 4 years old. And then when I was 7, I was the youngest of 5 children in the Midwest. And we kind of came from a lower middle class family. And my oldest brother, he was 15 at the time, got diagnosed with diabetes. And my parents were fairly unsophisticated people, so they pulled all the sugar out of the house. So now I'm 7 years old. I've already established at 4 years old that I'm willing to steal when I can't get what I need. And there's no sugar in my home. So that just amped up more of the stealing. So I would go to my best friend's house. They were twins and they were thin and their mother was Southern and she loved to cook and I loved to eat. It was a match made in heaven. And so I would be getting up in the middle of the night, getting into their freezer and things like that. And I would steal candy from teachers. I remember I was in catechism and I was in the fourth grade, I think, and I came out, you know, my sister and my mom was in the car and I had a big box of Valentine's candy. I mean, a big one, like a 1 pound box. And my mom said, where did that come from? And I said, oh, the teacher gave everybody one. She said, really? That's amazing. You know, and I'd stolen it, right? I was in the fourth grade. I'm thanking a teacher after a catechism class, right? And I'm stealing a box of candy off her desk, thinking she's probably not seeing, right? Just lots of stuff like that. Babysitting. Showing up in one babysitting job, the woman had made a homemade pie for her Aunt Margie that was coming tomorrow, right? It was my first time in the job. Here's the thing. I don't like pie, first of all. And if I was going to eat a pie, an apple pie would be probably the last pie I would eat. And she came back after this babysitting gig telling me that she'd made this pie. You can eat basically anything in my house, but please leave the pie alone. And I ate half of the pie. And I felt good about the fact that, well, I left half of it for Aunt Margie, right? Like, that kind of thinking, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's how broken I was. And it just continued. It continued on. And it didn't help that I had that happen at 4 years old. And then 6 years later, I got molested by that man's cousin, right? So I'm 10 years old, and I'm being driven around in the back of some man's Buick, right? Like, how did I get here? And it's really important for me to share with you, because that's a big, big part of my story, and we'll get to it when I get to the steps. But that was a huge, huge component of this. See, the eating, the sugar, the stealing, all that was just an opportunity and it fulfilled a necessity for me to dissociate, right? I could not be in my body. It was essential that I not be in my body and that I not feel, because it was too painful. And it wasn't only the pain of experiencing that, right? Somebody giving me inappropriate kisses in the front of a grocery store. Where is my mother, right? And at 4 years old, coming up with the solution, thank you, that I need to steal. So I already knew at 4 years old that the solution was not to call on my mother, right? To get in the car on the way home and say, hey, can you talk with him about this? Can you put the kibosh on this? I already knew that wasn't going to happen. That's a pretty incredible realization to already have at 4 years old, right? So then 6 years later, it's easy to understand how I end up in somebody's car, right? So then I go away to college and the trauma continues, right? As I've gained weight and, you know, freshman 15, what's that? Come on, give me 30. And I just continue to gain weight, and I'm stealing from roommates. I'm alienating roommates, right? Having roommates pass me down the dorm room hall. Like, who wants a room with her? Suite mates just locking their doors, right? Just that kind of stuff. That was my life. See, it would be great if having weighed 200 pounds had been the biggest problem that I had. It wasn't even close to being the biggest problem. I wish it was. Because then, you lose the weight, problem solved. That was not my problem. I had two problems. They're the same things I wrestle with today, to a lesser extent, a much lesser extent. But these are the problems. I do not love easily, and I do not forgive easily. And I should actually really qualify that. I actually love easily. I know how to love you. I do not know how to love me. Still, really. I mean, I've gotten much better. I've gotten much better. But that is still a real struggle for me. And while it's easy for me to love you, it is very hard for me to take care of you. It really is. You know, yesterday I'd gone down to a place in Hermosa Beach. I'd never been to this meeting. I was leading this meeting. You know, I'm in the Mother Fellowship as well. I'll be 28 years sober tomorrow. But, thank God, and I thank God that I surrendered and showed up. It is important to show up and surrender. But after the meeting, I was sitting in this parking structure, and I was listening. I'd gotten some outreach calls, because I'm big on outreach calls, and I'd gotten an outreach call from somebody, and this woman said something so lovely on the phone. Nobody has ever said anything this wonderful to me. And I sat in this parking structure, and I just sobbed. And I thought, I have to call her back and thank her for that. I realized I never thanked her. I never called her back. Because that would have involved taking it in. And I kept the message. I'm going to listen to it again, and I will call her today. But I realized that's a big part of my work now. I really need to work on taking your love in. Because the reality is, there's really nothing that holy about me being able to love you or give to you if I can't take in your love and let you give to me. Right? Because I'm actually giving you a gift when I receive your love, or when I receive whatever it is you want to give me. And if I'm, no, I'm unworthy, right? That nonsense, false pride stuff, right? I'm not giving you an opportunity to feel that good way that it feels when you give. So I've got to do that work. And then just as far as the forgiveness, right? Everything kind of cracked open for me when I got sponsored. And I got sponsored very, very well in this program. And I was told right from the beginning to start working the steps regardless of what was going on with the food. And I've had people who wanted to debate that with me. Like, is it okay to work the steps when you're still in the food? And all I know is, well, like, two things. I took my sponsor's direction, right? I was very clear that it was important to have a sponsor, and it wasn't enough to have a sponsor. I had to call her. And then I had to take her direction. And she told me, I want you to work those steps. Again, this was in the Midwest. She said, I don't care whether you're still in the sugar or not. You work those steps. And so, and also got largely influenced by the Alcoholics Anonymous of Bob Smith out of Ohio, because I'm from Michigan. So we were taught to just keep working the steps. You just keep cycling through the steps over and over and over again. So there were, you know, many four steps I did that, you know, literally I had a pen in one hand and a candy bar in the other. I was just about to say a Snickers bar, but I didn't eat Snickers. I like Milky Way because I don't like things with nuts. Right? I don't want to do too much chewing when I'm binging. So, yeah, I know. I never got it. Like, brownie with nuts? Why? But at any rate, and here's the thing. And in my first couple of years, I lost about 20 pounds in those first couple of years. So I was still at 180. And again, I'm just giving you numbers to give you. The numbers are unimportant. It doesn't matter what anybody weighs here. Period. Right? None of my business what anybody weighs. But I'm just giving you an idea of what my willingness was to feel my feelings and be present with my life. Right? So I'm a couple of years in about 20 pounds down, and my father had three overweight daughters, and he didn't like it. He made it real clear, and he would speak to us about it. But he spoke to me the most. I was the youngest, and I was the heaviest, and I think the most vulnerable. I was just an easy target. And I love, you know, my parents are deceased. He was well-intentioned, but you know, he was trying, he thought he was helping me, thought he was going to motivate me, you know. It doesn't motivate anybody to communicate that you're not lovable or you're not beautiful because of how you look. But my father just made a comment at a family event. So now I'm 20 pounds down, and I walked by, and he said something about how, well, I can see you're losing some weight, but you still got work to do. And I was 26 years old, and I turned around because I'd listened to him say that kind of nonsense to me, talking to me about my body for my lifetime. And I turned around, and I said, no more. No more. You do not talk to me about my body anymore. It's over. The game is over. And everybody in my family, you know, people were looking because nobody, you know, nobody did that. And I wasn't attempting to be disrespectful. I was standing in my value as a woman and a child of God. And a beautiful woman at that. A beautiful woman who weighed 180 pounds. And making it clear to him that I knew that. And I couldn't control whether he knew it, but I knew it. And he never talked to me about my weight again. So that was how it became clear to me, right? So I'm a couple years in OA. So I clearly haven't stopped. I haven't gotten out of the food yet. I haven't stopped sugar. I haven't stopped the quantity eating, clearly. I still weigh 180. But it was real clear to me that I had experienced recovery. And I'd been through the steps a couple of times at that point because I'm a couple years in. It takes about a year to get through. And so I got the value of working the steps regardless of whether or not I was in the food. Now, the great news is, because people in the rooms love to argue, and I thank God for Al-Anon, really, and Al-Anon sponsors, right? because I don't argue with people here, but people, and people always want to tell me about it, how, you can't work the steps, and there are whole groups in Overeaters Anonymous who believe that you can't work the steps if you're in the food. Here's the thing that I've found in my experience here is everybody's doing this and everybody's doing it right. All I know is, because it tells me that experience is the thing of supreme value in life, that's what I have to offer you. All I can tell you is 2 years into this, I was still in the food, I'd been through the steps a couple of times, and I got to stand up respectfully, but clearly and strongly and proudly and communicate to the man who had communicated to me for a lifetime that I had no value because of what I weighed and say, no, you are mistaken, I do have value, and you stop talking about my body and my weight. That was real recovery. Nobody could ever tell me that that isn't recovery. That's how I knew empirically that working the steps, regardless of what was going on with the food, was powerful. I was not ready to put down the food. I wasn't done. That's the only reason that somebody comes here month after month, year after year, decade after decade, and if they are potentially still struggling, because they're not done. And what's behind the not done? Not being ready to feel the feelings. Do you want to be the person to say to somebody who's not ready to feel the feelings that you don't get to work the steps and start peeling the layer of the onion? I don't want to say that to anybody. And here's the good news, right? You get to point to our literature. Because thank God I've got a sponsor, Deanna turned me on to it. Sponsor that I have, this woman, love her, really love her. No, I do, for real. I love it. Whenever anybody gives me something to do, and I just think, oh, you've got to be kidding me. This is nonsense. What is ludicrous? You know who you're talking to, right? And thank God that stuff stays in my head. But whenever that happens, I can't wait to do what they ask me to do, because I know I'm going to have a huge blessing come out of it, right? And this woman's thing is, well, you need to be at 5 meetings a week. It's like, 5 meetings? There's not much room for argument with her. But so at any rate, I ended up at this meeting that I hadn't been to, this wonderful meeting on a Sunday morning, and we read the OA 12 and 12. And I love the OA literature. I've done that workbook, four or five times. Love it. Love all our stuff. I've read all our stuff. But, the truth is I spend the bulk of my time in AA literature. Quite frankly, I spend the bulk of my time in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was reading our, thank you, sorry, five left here. I was reading our OA 12 and 12, and I think it's on page 31, and it's in the fourth step, okay? So the big kahuna step. And it says, it's probably a good idea for you to put the food down before you do this, but do whatever makes sense to you, right? Just do the steps. And I thought, bingo! I got material, right? I got literature. So that just makes it even easier to not argue, and there's nothing to debate here. There's nothing to debate. And because I struggled, I just want to take you home with this in my last few minutes here, is because I struggled and I was a chronic flipper, I sponsor chronic flippers exclusively in this program and in the mother program. I always say I want the spunky that nobody else wants, right? I really do. And not because I'm not your mother, I'm not a drill sergeant, I'm not a bitch, right? I'm clear, right? Now, if you're in the food or in the sugar or doing the quantity eating, right, and you've stepped up and you've invited me into your life, and we start having loving conversations, because again, remember, I learned if being mean was going to solve my problems, weight or otherwise, my dad would have solved my problems in childhood. So I know that doesn't work. And plus, that's not my thing. But if somebody's being clear with you, and you've got that stuff going on, sometimes that feels mean, or it might be easy to kind of take that victim route and say that it's mean, right? Because chronic slippers are chronic victims and chronic liars, and I that's me, right? I got my hand raised 12 years, right? I needed, and the reality of it was I came by being a victim, honestly, right? I had bad stuff happen to me in my childhood, so I was a victim. But the problem with kind of carrying and perpetuating that going forward, if I don't work the steps, is if I'm living in a victim mentality, the world is going to continue to give me opportunities to be a victim, right? So what happened as I work the steps, and when I take people through the steps of the book, and I get clear in that fourth column like I did, despite the fact this seems unfathomable to contemplate, I actually had a part in terms of that experience when I was 10 years old. In no way was I responsible for the fact that somebody molested me, but I was certainly responsible for the fact that I hadn't forgiven this person, right? This man, let's just call him Joe. I hadn't forgiven Joe. So I was responsible for that. That was part of what I had, right? And the book tells me in terms of the fourth column, I got to find out where am I fearful, where am I dishonest, right? And it's easy to see where I was fearful if something like that happens. Dishonesty, well, I've done hurtful things to people, right? I want to be forgiven. Do I really want to have Joe on my list to be living with that? I want forgiveness, but I don't want to forgive him. That doesn't make sense, right? And is it selfish? You know, for a long time, that tragedy defined me, right? Well, it was all about me. And the reality is, as my sponsor pointed out at the time when I was reading this fifth step, it was a horrible thing to have happen. And there are horrible things going on all over the world. 20% of the children in this country deal with hunger on a daily basis. You know, there's all kinds of tragedies. I don't want my tragedy to be what defines me. So I saw that fourth column stuff. The big book says I made my eight-step list when I took my four-step. So then when I get to a nine-step, my sponsor is bringing home the point that I owe an amends to Joe, which will come through a letter. I did not need to contact Joe. Don't get nervous, right? But she did have me write a letter. And there were three things in the letter. Because we don't get a lot of direction in that book about how to make amends, you're dependent upon a lineage of good sponsorship. And I have always paid attention to who my sponsor is, right? And so the direction I got was, Dear Joe, I forgive you for having molested me. Please forgive me for not having forgiven you for 15 years. And then she directed me to write something nice about Joe. Because if somebody's done something horrible, I see them through that telescope. That's all that they are. That's not all that he was. As I am not all of my worst moments. I am so much more than that, right? Can you see how it talks about when the book, when it says that the promises, and don't, for me, it wasn't about a God in the heaven. God is within me. But it wasn't that God was saying, okay, good, you've done more than half your amends. Ka-bing, I'm going to start throwing the promises at you. It doesn't go that way. What happened was my heart opened, right? Because, and I heard that timer, because if I was able to do that big forgiveness, everything else was a piece of cake, right? And you have given me everything here. You opened my heart, and I could see all the blessings that have always been there. So again, I am so grateful on this day. I am so grateful for Overeaters Anonymous. I owe you my life. I will be here for the rest of my life because I can never pay you back for what you have given me and what you have given my family just by me being here. I so thank you and bless you. Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you.
Howard, can we have Howard to the stage, please? Howard to the stage.
Good morning. Happy Thanksgiving. And I want to thank Deanna and the rest of the committee for inviting me to speak here. My name is Howard. I'm a compulsive overeater. I've been blessed with 28, coming up soon on 29 years of abstinence. And the removal, and I believe safe storage in an undisclosed location of about a little more than 150 pounds that will be returned to me if I start looking at it as an accomplishment, because it really is a gift. It's a gift of the program, and it's a gift from God. People always like to talk about their life story, and I'm no different. I was born in a small town back east, maybe some of you have heard of it, New York City. On a rainy, miserable night in the last month of the 1940s. So I've been around quite a while. And, you know, the reason I know what the weather was like when I was born is because every year on my birthday, my father would say, "Oh, yeah, I remember when you were born. It was a rainy, miserable night, and I had to go down to that lousy hotel." I was born in a hospital where I was born. I wasn't sick or anything. I just wanted to be close to my mother. Prior to that, it was a hotel on the boardwalk in Coney Island called the Half Moon Hotel, and that's the place where I was born. It has a nefarious place in New York history that has nothing to do with me. Anyway, I just grew up with the feeling that I wasn't wanted. Wherever I was, I could stay, and you know, I'd be allowed to stay, but the people would rather that I be somewhere else and not bothering them. And, you know, it wasn't a pleasant feeling as a child. It's not a pleasant feeling growing up or as an adult. But I grew up with this feeling. And another thing that I was taught as a child is, if you feel bad, eat something, and you'll feel better. And, you know, I like to say, coming from a working-class New York City Jewish family, there's a lot of guilt, a lot of shame. Plus, all you can eat 24 hours a day. You know, I hear people talk about, eating food out of the garbage. I could never understand that. But then I realized recently that in my family, there never was any food in the garbage. Anyway, I went from being a chubby kid to a fat teenager to an obese young adult, and finally, as my weight was approaching 400 pounds, I was a morbidly obese adult. And, you know, over the years, I kind of realized what I was eating, like everybody else, to suppress feelings. Feelings of anger, feelings of fear, you know, I was eating to suppress my sex drive, too, because there wasn't a lot of that available to me, you know, except what I paid for. Eating to suppress your sex drive, eventually you can't even get into your own pants. Anyway, along the way, I learned other ways to deal with, you know, all these bad feelings. I constantly was smoking. I would go on drinking binges. I come to realize I'm not an alcoholic, although I do now abstain from alcohol. Alcohol was just one of my binge foods, you know, just something that I used just like anything else. And for me, it was never sugar and candy and all that stuff. It's a good thing because I have a vending machine business. A good binge for me was a herd of cattle, a pitchfork, and a 55-gallon drum of ketchup, you know. That's what a good binge was. Anyway, somehow along the way, I got, like I said, I was 37 years old when I came to the program. I found a woman that was willing to marry me, and we had two kids, and that also added to my fears, the fears of being a failure as a father, because I'm not going to go into a lot of issues with my father, but there are a lot of issues, you know. You guys want to leave at some point, so I'm not even going to go into that. Anyway, my body at 37 years old, my weight approaching 400 pounds was starting to break down. I had high blood pressure, which was not really controlled by medication. I had rashes from nerves and also from things rubbing together that aren't supposed to rub together. And, you know, I had a severe case of sleep apnea. I was one of the pioneers on the CPAP machine back in 1986. I started using a CPAP machine, which turned out to be a blessing because I could finally get some sleep. You know, just that again was one of my problems. I wasn't not sleeping at night. Anyway, I read about Overeaters Anonymous in the Los Angeles Times. It was an interview with a man named Richie Kay, and I really, really liked what he said. I liked hearing about the meetings. The meetings sounded interesting to me. The steps, not so much, because I knew about the steps, because I had been to one and only one Gamblers Anonymous meeting. And I read the steps up on the wall, and most of them I said no to. A few of them I said hell no to, specifically 4, 8, and 9. You know, it was just no way I was going to go through that. I was going to do that. Anyway, I wanted to go to this overeaters meeting, didn't know where it was or how to get there. And so, you know, months had passed. I was talking about it. I mentioned it to my wife. In fact, she showed me the article in the Times. And finally, she said, she brought me a phone number. And I said, where did you get the phone number? She said she got out of the phone book. And frankly, how somebody could be anonymous and in the phone book, I still don't understand. But I called the number. There was no such thing as online in 1980. It was 1987, or at least there was no such thing in my world. And there was a recording that just spewed out the meetings. And I was listening. And finally, it got to Thursday night, 8 o'clock. It was a meeting that I could get to. I could get to that meeting. It was about 100 yards away from where I lived in Northridge. And they said new people should come at 7:30. So I went at 7:30, and there was just one guy there. And they did have the steps up on the wall, much to my disappointment. I thought they eliminated the more objectionable ones or just eliminated them altogether, even though they called it a 12-step program. There was just one guy there, and I said, well, what kind of meeting is this? Turns out he was there just for the new people. And I'm very grateful that this guy was there. His name was Mel. And Mel and I sat down and talked, and we developed a rapport. And I felt comfortable talking to Mel. And then the meeting started, and there was maybe 20 or 30 people. And they were, I believe God sent these people to be a group that I could be comfortable with. And it was like 90 minutes that the knot in my stomach was untied. And I felt comfortable. I felt wanted there. They told me to keep coming back. I couldn't believe it. I'd never heard that before. And I knew, as a businessman, that everything has a price. And I didn't believe the price was the few dollars that you were expected to donate to the meeting. There had to be more to pay. And I assumed that I had to abstain. Otherwise, I wouldn't be welcome anymore. The steps were completely verboten for me. I mean, I wanted nothing to do with any of that stuff. But I started abstaining. I heard at that meeting that somebody said the abstinence was eating three times a day with nothing in between. And I said, I can do that because I can see the loopholes. You know, if I wanted to have cereal in the morning, I could use a bowl that should have a lifeguard. And I could have lunch off a satellite dish. And this was the 1980s when satellite dishes were really big, you know. But I started to say, I also started exercising because I wanted to lose weight. I didn't know I was crazy. I knew I was fat. But I really didn't know how crazy I was. And so I started doing that. I started eating three times a day, very large amounts of food, but stopping three times a day, which was not easy, but I was able to do it. And I started losing weight. It was miraculous. I mean, it was just pouring off me initially. Just the exercise I was doing, which I became obsessed with, and only eating three times a day. And what happened then, because I wasn't smoking anymore, I wasn't drinking very often, and I wasn't gambling because I just stopped. I don't know. It's all interconnected somehow. But I stopped doing all those things, and that's when the real craziness came up. When I wasn't suppressing anything anymore, and I got so crazy that. You know, a lot of, how many people haven't heard me speak before? I hope there's a lot. Oh, terrific. This is a really good story. But I've told it 10,000 times. What happened was a situation came up where I wound up being, it was like something coming at me. I could see it coming at me, but I didn't get out of the way, which I should have. And I wound up, it turned into a violent situation. And I wound up being arrested, taken to jail for assault, and in three sets of handcuffs. Not because I fought with the police. I was crazy, but I wasn't stupid, you know. Because my arms wouldn't go together behind me, that they had a link to the handcuffs. And, you know, I was put in a jail cell. It was, I think it's what they call the drunk tank. There was a bunch of beds in the room. And there was just one other guy in there. And I sat down, and then I lied down. And I called my wife and told her where I was and asked her to please come and bail me out. And not really having a high level of codependency, she said she'll get there as soon as she can, and I should wait there for her. And, you know, in abstinence, in jail, is where I hit bottom, absolutely hit bottom. I just realized that everything I'd ever done in my entire life had brought me to that point. Oh, by the way, I was given a cavity search before I was put into the jail cell. And it wasn't my teeth that they looked at. And, you know, there was everything I'd ever done in my entire life had brought me to that point, and there I was in jail, and a policeman had just looked up my ass. And clearly, I was not going in the right direction. You know, things were not as they were supposed to be, and I knew I had to do something. Again, I was crazy, but I wasn't stupid. I knew that this was not a good thing, and I decided that those steps, as objectionable as they were, is something I needed to try. Because I wanted to, either I wanted the promises that the steps bring, or I wanted to prove that they didn't work and go on and look for something else. But I wanted to do it, and I got that first man that I met in the program, Mel, to ask him to be my sponsor and to guide me through the steps. He said he'd do it. Every week I went to his house, we read together, we prayed together, he gave me questions to answer, and things to write about, and whatever Mel told me to do, I did. You know, I didn't debate. I didn't argue. I just did what I was told, as best as I could, which was not that great. But apparently, it was good enough, because I went through the process as I was directed to do, and it's now, you know, almost three decades later, and I'm no longer in my 30s, I'm in my 60s. In fact, in about a week, I'll be 66 years old, and I find it good. And I don't have any health problems, you know, and just, and the weight is gone, and it doesn't seem to be coming back. So apparently what I did was good enough, and, you know, some of the gifts that I've been given is those, you know, still married. This having the last word for a man who's been married for 36 years is a rare experience. But, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a father of two grown daughters. I like to call them trophy daughters. And they don't have addiction problems. They're okay with themselves. You know, they're happy. My older daughter gave birth about 2 years ago, so I'm a grandfather now. And, you know, my life is good. It's not perfect. Don't have everything I want. Don't want everything I have. But, you know, my life is okay. And I don't really have a whole lot more to say. I'll just say that my name is Howard. I'm a compulsive overeater, and I approve of this message. Thank you.
Thanks, Howard. I, too, approve of your message. Okay, so let us take a moment to thank all of our great speakers again. Thank you, Alexis, Sheila, and Howard.